This is part 3 of a 6-part series. Homestead.
Of all the springs, perhaps the Bath Spring was the one most enjoyed. This spring was not discovered for more than a year after Pa had preempted his claim. The family was still living at Hot Sulphur Springs, but in late summer of 1875 made a camping trip to Bear River to see where their new home would be. They were accompanied by John and Annie Crawford, Pa's brother and sister-in-law, from Sedalia, Missouri. While Pa was hunting deer on the sagebrush slopes of the foot of Storm Mountain on August 1st, he followed a game trail down the hill to a small creek and blundered into a bubbling spring in the middle of the stream. The water was hot, but not hot enough to scald his horse. Pa thought it would be just right for bathing. Hurrying to camp, he hitched up the team and brought Maggie and the children and John and Annie to take a bath. The only other spring that had heretofore been used for bathing was the bubbling sulfur spring at the opposite end of the valley. When Pa had discovered that spring the previous summer, it had already been hollowed out and rocks laid around it, an indication that Indians or mountain men had used it. It was only tepid. The spring at the east end of the valley was 103 degrees Fahrenheit, and the flow later proved to be 225 gallons per minute.
What is today a major tourist town with a population of 12,000 started as a single log cabin built by one man in the spring of 1874. Its downtown runs along the Yampa Valley, consisting of 12 numbered streets from Old Town Hot Springs to the Sulphur and Soda Springs. Across Lincoln Avenue, you can visit the Iron Spring, or the Crawford Spring, as it was known to the Crawfords. Across the Yampa, you'll find the Train Depot, the Black Sulphur Spring, and the Steamboat Spring. Strangely, when I visited, the Black Sulphur Spring was milky white. Apparently, it alternates color as the sulfur in the water interacts with the air and surrounding soil. Many mineral springs give off an odor, described politely as eggs and impolitely as rancid farts. To describe it as farts wouldn't be wrong. It's the result of sulfur-reducing bacteria eating the sulfur and excreting hydrogen sulfide, a poisonous, corrosive, flammable, invisible gas. Just as an environment predominantly of hydrogen sulfide would kill us in minutes, the oxygen environment we call air slowly dissolves the bodies of sulfur-feasting bacteria. That's why we associate this smell with rot, sewers, swamps, and the ends of our own digestive tracts. They want to be warm, mobile, and safe from oxygen. This kind of organism ruled the planet for 1.5 billion years before bacteria that draw energy from the sun via photosynthesis, cyanobacteria, farted our current oxygen-rich atmosphere into existence. As the environment became toxic, the aerobic bacteria retreated underwater, underground, and inside of more complex organisms. Seams of underground water are perfect for their purposes. Their gas byproduct is harmless to us in open-air environments, although it's known to rapidly strip the paint off of houses in Steamboat Springs. It is one of the many underground gases that kill miners and fuel underground explosions. There's even a small cave in the hills of Steamboat Springs lined with a unique form of life that creates snotites, stalactites that hang and wobble like snot. They have only been found in one other cave, in Mexico, and apparently require a hydrogen sulfide atmosphere to live.
There's been some crazy, amazing developments that have been coming out around our sulfur cave, which was just named a national landmark, natural landmark. The sulfur cave is sort of up on Howson Hill at the base, And that cave has a rare species of bloodworms that's found in only like one or two other places on Earth.
Danny sees the sulfur cave as instrumental in bringing attention back to the springs.
So it's just kind of a change in attitude, a change in people, and really this better understanding of our environment and how important it is to us. And I think one of the springboards for that was probably the designation of the sulfur cave and spring. So that's now a historic national landmark. Having had that spring around for so long and still finding new things in it is kind of that catapult that then says to other people, well, what do these other springs have to offer that we don't know about? Even if it's not a benefit to humans, there's probably a benefit within the environment. So I think all of those things coming together right now are spurring this to happen.
The smell so blankets the historical downtown of Steamboat Springs that locals refer to the area as Fart Park. I can only imagine what it's like working in the library that now adjoins the Sulphur Springs and getting a large whiff of that every day as you come into work. Even with the wonders of modern AC, the scent pervades the inside of the library. It's only a fraction of what visitors would have smelled lodging in the 100-room hotel in the summertime when breezes through the open windows were the only cooling. This is also the spot where James Crawford staked his claim, to the annoyance of the 150 or so Ute who lived, grazed, hunted, and farmed that valley during the summertime. When James carved his claim notice into the aspen near the Steamboat Geyser in 1874, he found a Ute encampment and a bath around the bubbling sulfur spring. In the hills nearby, he also found a collapsed cabin and a yoke that a tree had grown around. The yoke was always a bit of a mystery because no one was known to have brought oxen or wagons into the valley before the Crawfords' arrival. In 1949, the Denver Post ran a short feature mentioning it and received a letter from a man in Wisconsin who said that his father had perhaps become lost in the valley in 1849 on his way to California. Fastidious local historians have found journal entries from a half dozen or so visitors who remarked on the springs and the sulfur cave as they passed through the area. Crawford did something none of them had. He staked his claim in accordance with the Homestead Act of 1862. Virtually since arrival, white Americans demanded more and more land from the occupants of the Americas. Each time they did, the bloody and acrimonious debate arose as to whether that land should allow slavery or not. Beyond the enormous moral implications, the debate also concerned whether the land would be colonized by large landholders and corporations, as was common throughout the South, or by small landholders, romantically called yeoman farmers, in Jefferson's ideas. The vision that many Northerners had for rural parts of the country was self-employed individuals constantly improving the land and reaping the benefits of those improvements in a perpetual act of civilizing a wild continent and self-improvement. Notably, neither side of this debate cared much about the well-being of the Indians, and they found legal levers to dispossess them each year. Especially as white Americans crossed the Appalachians into the Great Plains, the semi-nomadic lifestyle of American Indians was good enough reason to build houses and farms on their hunting and grazing land. As several experiments in peacefully deciding the question of slavery failed, the United States annexed a third of Mexico, including its most resource-rich areas, as it struggled to rebuild from its protracted and bloody war of independence from Spain. Significant American communities in California were staunchly anti-slavery, while settlers in Texas, who had precipitated the Mexican-American War, did so explicitly to expand slavery, which Mexico had abolished. An attempt to deal with this crisis allowed white settlers in Kansas to vote on whether that state should allow slavery or not, which turned into a proxy civil war. Then, a new political party swept the 1860 election, a party that was avowed to ending the barbarity in the South and the West. In 1861, the South seceded, which allowed Republicans to initiate their plan to end slavery by force. In 1862, with only northern and border states represented in Congress, they passed the Homestead Act. Any American could claim 160 acres of land, including women and former slaves, if they made their claim properly and improved the land, which usually meant building a house and a farm on it, no matter how small. The entire process took 7 years, minus the time a man had served in active duty, which about a tenth of Northerners did by the end of the Civil War. It exempted immigrants and anyone who had taken up arms as rebels, so Southerners. The North had claimed the West and created a method for legally colonizing it. And legally here is a bit of a broad term. In light of the new finders keepers rule, Americans boldly colonized lands that belonged to American Indian nations, knowing that before long, the land would become theirs by treaty. After all, land in the Americas had always worked on a finders keepers basis for Europeans. Again and again, Sooners proved correct. If they could illegally hold their land against the Indians for long enough, they would eventually come to legally own it. And increasingly, they found federal military support for their efforts. Again, keep in mind that this was land that the American Indians lived and grazed on, but because they moved around, they often returned to find their favorite spots, even holy grounds, occupied by hostile whites. When they fought back, they were in breach of treaties and further removed, where the process was repeated again, later in their lifetimes or in the lifetime of the next generation. Of course, homesteaders didn't see themselves as ravenous conquerors. People in the moment don't think like historians, appraising their motives from afar. Everyone wants a better life for themselves and their families, and that's exactly what the Homestead Act harnessed into a colonizing force. These were not well-armed military contingents carving out swaths of a map. These were instead ambitious young men and poor families looking for a decent, if difficult, living on the frontier. Steamboat Springs. James Crawford enlisted in the Union Army with the Missouri State Militia Cavalry when he was 16 and served for 3 years, time that he would take off of his homestead claim. When he was 20, the Civil War ended. He married, bought a farm, and had 3 children. 7 years later, he toured Colorado with Robert Steele, who had been the governor of the territory of Jefferson, an extra-large version of Colorado that was proposed by miners and settlers in the area. Steele, a vocal supporter of the South during the Civil War, lost his position when Republicans in D.C. incorporated the territory as the Colorado Territory in 1861. A decade later, he was apparently still living in the state giving tours. Even at this stage, James had a clear idea of his mission. He wrote in his diary,
"All that I saw looked good, and from that time forward I was determined to go in and possess the country."
He reacted to the smells.
"The water is well saturated with sulfur, and it continues to the present time to attract the attention of the olfactories."
And he fell in love with the place.
"I said to Richardson, 'This is the place for me. Let's take up the ground now, come back as soon as we can, and make a start.'"
James built his claim cabin and headed back to Missouri, satisfied that the valley would soon be his. The next year, he sold the farm, packed up the family, and headed west with 2 wagons and a few friends headed to Denver. Finally, in 1876, the Crawford family brought their wagon over the Rabbit Ear Pass into Yampa Valley. It's also the year that the Colorado Territory became a state. I'll let Lulita narrate from here. Lulita was the granddaughter of James and his wife Margaret, but she refers to them as Ma and Pa here. Most of her stories are told secondhand from her mother's perspective, so it often sounds like we're listening to Luli, Lulita's mother and James's daughter.
"Those teepees housed many of the same Ute Indians the Crawfords had known in Middle Park. Most of the Indians belonged to the Yarmany, a friendly band. Among them were a few restless young braves, the renegades Colorado, Pilaf, and others. Almost before Jack and Jim, the mules, had brought the wagon to a stop, some of the squaws came calling, happy to renew their biscuit and sugar relationship with Ma. The Crawfords had expected to occupy Pa's claim cabin, which he had started on his exploratory trip and roofed the next April with the help of Lute Carlton. But they found the cabin already occupied by a stranger named Caleb C. Clements. Caleb had a stock of goods to trade to the Utes and was doing such a good business that he did not want to move. He was abiding by an unwritten frontier law that gave anyone the privilege of taking shelter in a vacant cabin and using whatever he needed as long as he filled the wood box when he left and washed the dishes, if there were any dishes. Pa did not hurry Caleb. "There's room enough for us all," he said.
We can see the complex relationships of colonization forming. The Ute were no fools. They could see the imminent threat to their rights and their way of life. Lulita notes later in her account,
"Even here on Bear River, the Crawfords were never entirely free from fear of attack. Though Yarmini had so far been able to control his braves, a few were openly hostile. With long fingers, they scratched in the ground and threatened, 'Utes dirt! Big Jim, go back!'"
I had to do some digging to get to the bottom of the question of whether this settlement was legal under U.S. law, or if it was a sooner settlement, like Oklahoma, the Dakotas, and earlier in Colorado history. In this case, the treaty in place was the Ute Treaty of 1868, and it specifies that the eastern border of Ute land was the 170th meridian, and the north border was between the White and Yampa rivers. Steamboat is on the north bank of the Yampa River and at the 169th meridian, which means that the land was open for settlement under the treaty, just very, very close to the Ute reservation. That said, most Ute groups did not take this treaty seriously. For one, the group that signed it, led by Chief Array, did not have authority to negotiate on behalf of all Ute groups. The U.S. was well-versed in dealing with American Indian customs at this point, so they used gift-giving, like lavish trips that they took Array on, and presidential medals, medals coined for Indian chiefs that they claimed were very prestigious, when in fact most Americans had never heard of them, to negotiate these uneven treaties. Perhaps most importantly, though, the payments promised from the U.S. in this Ute treaty never arrived, so most Ute considered the treaty to be void anyway.
That goes back to those broken treaties where land appropriations were set, and then that was not what was followed. That's not where they are. That's not where they were put. That's not the land that they were able to access at that time.
But despite the distrust of white settlers, the Ute appreciated support and friendship, like we all do.
Absolutely. And I think that's sort of the story of our communities today as well, right? You know, we have these sort of broad sweeping inequalities and issues that often looks like we're taking steps backwards in history. And then what you see on that micro level is the helpers, are the people who are working tirelessly, are the organizations and initiatives that are doing everything in their power to create change and make sure that we don't go backwards. And I think that's really the story, a lot of the story of the Crawford family.
These colonizers provided food that doesn't grow in the Rockies, like sugar, and specialized cast iron tools, not to mention access to wider markets. To a certain extent, it was mutually beneficial to allow colonizers in. Besides which, Ute knew that they had limited options. Having accepted unequal treaties at gunpoint, they wanted to avoid bringing down the fury of the federal military again. We can see how high tensions were in this episode just months after the family's arrival in Steamboat. Keep in mind that this is a narration from a direct descendant writing in 1977 in Denver. She has a rather rosy view of colonization and a pretty infantilizing view of American Indians, despite her attempts to be progressive. So just keep that in mind as you hear this.
On the morning of the 4th, the Indians were the first to arrive. As curious as children, they squatted about the pole and the cabin. When Mike Farley and the Harrison brothers had ridden in, they, together with Pa and Ma, Luli, Logan, and John marched down the gentle slope to the flagpole with considerable formality, Pa leading the way and carrying a large flag. There he and Ma unfolded the bunting so all could admire the red and white stripes and the blue field in one corner. In that field were 37 stars. The Indians began to withdraw, muttering among themselves. No doubt they had observed flags waving at forts and agencies, and they were suspicious that new restraints were about to be put upon them. Pa sought to assure them that here on Bear River, the flag would watch over both red and white men. Having fought under the banner 3 years in the struggle to preserve the Union, his feeling for it was deep. His earnestness spoke better than his attempted use of sign language or the few Indian words he knew. And soon the Utes gathered close again.
Lilita fails to note that James had, in fact, claimed the valley for the United States. He had staked a claim by carving it into the aspen tree beside the Steamboat Geyser in 1874. But for all their cultural differences, these were two groups of people surviving in the same landscape. The Crawfords ultimately lived very similarly to the Ute. They ate roots, foraged berries, hunted, and set up their farm. They gave gifts and helped each other.
There was a good feeling at Steamboat Springs after the flag raising. The Ute braves sometimes helped Pa bring in his horses. The squaws gave Ma wild raspberries on big, clean thindleberry leaves and showed her how to dig yampa roots and pound them into meal to thicken soup or gravy. Charlie Yarmandy, the chief's son, and Logan hunted chipmunks together, with bows the chief made for them, using sharpened sticks for arrows.
Now, be aware that the term squaw is offensive because of its association with war wives, indigenous women who were forced into sexual slavery and prostitution over the protracted Indian Wars. When Lilita used it in the 70s, she simply meant American Indian wives and mothers. It appears that the Ute accepted the Crawfords and accepted them into their gift-giving exchange, even if it wasn't entirely consensual.
If there was anyone to visit, they went visiting. They learned never to wait dinner and to stretch a meal to feed however many unexpected guests appeared.
The frequent Ute visits also made it clear that they were not ceding their own claim to the valley. It's worth noting that for all the friendship expressed between the Crawfords and the Ute, tension never lay far behind. One reason the Ute accepted white settlement was the access to hard alcohol. Some of the more aggressive men, including the anti-settlement Chief Colero, were known to get drunk on whiskey and threaten scalpings. He once scalped Luli's doll, and in an incident at a homestead down the river, he and his friends held down a young woman inside of her house and acted out scalping her. She wasn't hurt, but obviously it was a violation and a threat. The Ute were prepared to fight for their valley, and they had already fought for it, at least once in Yarmany's lifetime. Several fields of arrowheads attested to earlier battles.
Yarmady told Mr. Crawford that the battle occurred when he was about 6 or 8 years old, indicating that the battle took place in about 1816 or 1817. The Arapahoes took position on a hill just at the bend of the river. At this point, they were enabled to shoot into the Ute teepees, thereby annoying, doubtless injuring, the squaws and papooses. The Ute sought temporary forts in positions so as to direct the arrows of the enemies away from their camp. The battle lasted 3 days. It became evident to the Utes that they were getting the worst of it, and the third day, under the cover of the darkness, they all moved down the river. The steamboat pilot, 1935.
The Ute thought the Crawfords were crazy when they declined to leave the mountain valley as winter set in.
When cold season approached, the Utes warned of big snow and migrated with the deer to Lower Sand and Cedar counties to the west. Pa hardly knew what to expect, but he laid in provisions and drove most of his stock to Burns Hole, a sheltered valley some 50 miles south of Steamboat Springs and known to Indians and mountain men. He kept one milk cow, a white one named Lil, and a couple of horses. depending for feed on a small stack of native hay he had cut by hand.
Their fellow white settlers appeared to feel the same, as one winter was often enough to convince them to seek a more connected and developed place to live. Other farms and cabins dotted the nearby rivers, but none was destined to become a town like Steamboat Springs. Crawford, unlike many of his peers, had little interest in striking it rich with mineral claims. The Yampa Valley was not known to have gold or silver, although it has seen mining in the 20th century. Crawford cared about ranching, farming, and building a town. But none of it would have been possible if not for Meeker.
Years have a way of melding into each other. Sometimes even the people who witnessed an event cannot be sure exactly when it took place, and they may differ as to just what took place. But there are certain indisputable pillars of remembrance.
One such pillar is September 29th, 1879, a day that changed the lives of Ute and white settlers alike in the Colorado Rockies forever.